I thank the organizers for this great workshop that I'm learning a lot from and interacting quite a lot with other peoples. And this opportunity for me to tell you a bit about work that has been done in collaboration with Miguel Casalilla in Spain, who should be arriving on Wednesday, I guess, and Thierry Jamaki, who was here about 2 months ago, I guess. My source of funding is from EPSRC in the UK. I should acknowledge really useful discussions with people from the Birmingham Theory Group, which Mike is here and nobody else, Nicola?
No. Should be coming.
Right, and Martin Long in particular, and also Sasha Gogolin, and also Jason Ho for the multi-band part. So I'm going to start off with a few transparencies just to motivate the stuff, and then I'll get onto the blackboard. Oh, yes. I want to do the play bit, I guess. Okay. So as most people in this workshop already know, there's a new environment for studying quantum many-body systems. Here, for this talk, I want to concentrate mainly on ultra-cold atoms trapped in optical lattices, and in particular in quasi-1D geometry. So for people who doesn't know how we can do 1D physics in cold atoms, here are a few slides. So the way you do it is basically you trap atoms by some other means like evaporative cooling and so on into a blob here. This is not just one atom, but a blob. And then you add counter-propagating lasers. So you have two counter-propagating lasers of the same frequency and wavelength and so on, and then they interfere to give you a standing wave pattern. So with two sets like this, orthogonal sets, you form a 2D square lattice where each lattice site is in fact a 1D tube. By turning up the strength of the lasers, you can make these confinement in this perpendicular direction, perpendicular to the tube direction, very strong. And you can really form isolated 1D tubes, isolated from the other tubes.
Which is the direction of the tube on the picture with the arrows?
Okay, so this is the direction of the tube. Because you form a periodic potential like this, and at the bottom of the periodic potential, you have a tube. Okay? And if you have three sets of lasers, then you can get a 3D square cubic lattice like that. And you can change the third direction lattice again to make it stronger or weaker, to form a stronger or weaker type of Hubbard model. What do we need to know? The energy scales here are really low, like nano-Kelvin scales, because of the need to trap atoms in these tubes. And another thing that's interesting is the length scale here. It's huge compared to in ordinary solids. And the other thing, of course, is that unlike in solids, you can tune things in situ in the same system. For example, the interaction strength can be tuned either directly by having a stronger confinement in each lattice site that effectively frustrates your T compared to U, or you can add an extra knob like a Feshbach resonance. So you can, in principle, tune U over T to be on order from of order 1 up to, well, effectively very large. And then there's another way of doing 1D or quasi-1D systems, and this is in ultra-cold atoms trapped in chip traps. So what you have is basically some semiconductor substrate, which is this black thing here, and then you can write nanowires like these wires here or these wires here. And basically the current going through the wire will define a certain magnetic field potential, and if you're imaginative, you can define your potential in a certain way to make sure that the atoms are trapped in these fields. So, for example, Schmidt-Meyer's group in Heidelberg has managed to persuade atoms to be trapped into this spiral and send them in with some velocity going down and going back. It's quite a cute thing if you want to take a look at their website for a video of this. Similarly, in Imperial, Ed Hines' group has pioneered a different kind of chip trap where you have a magnetic videotape, basically. It's literally a videotape. They just buy some videotape And then they use a video head, recorder head, to write magnetic domains. Again, the magnetic field then provide the confinement. You also need some other confinement using current carrying wires. But basically, the magnetic field patterns can give rise to, again, a strong trapping potential to form a quasi-1D geometry. And BECs has been seen in this system already, although not really in the 1D limit yet. So what has people seen in these 1D quasi-1D geometry or 1D geometry? So I guess one of the most interesting experiments has been in Emmanuel Bloch's group in 2004, and there are also work in David Weiss' group at Penn State and Esslinger's group in Zurich, where they basically go into the limit where these tubes are not talking to each other. So you make the transverse confinement very strong by turning up the lasers very strong. In 1D, there is, I'll say a few more words later, but in 1D, because interactions is basically confined along a 1D axis, interaction and statistics are intermingled. So if you try to do an exchange of two particles like this, in 1D you necessarily collide, and so you end up mixing statistics and interactions. So you get things like fermions looking a bit like bosons and bosons looking a bit like fermions and so on. And in the limit where you have extremely strong interaction in between bosons, you get these 1D hardcore bosons, which has something like a free fermion description. And in particular, in the Luttinger liquid description, the momentum distribution N of P has this form with K being the Luttinger liquid parameter, and K equals 1 is the case for hardcore bosons or free fermions. And so in the experiment, what they have measured here is the momentum distribution function coming out of the time of flight expansion imaging. And I guess the interesting bit here is this dashed line here, which is the power law correlation that would be expected from Luttinger liquid theory. Here they actually plotted it for the K equals 1 limit. And the interaction here is pretty strong. So gamma here is the ratio between potential energy to kinetic energy, and it's 30 here. The other bits here is because in the Bloch experiment, he also has a periodic lattice parallel to the tube direction. So you get an extra Bragg peak. And this round off here is because of finite size and finite temperature, unfortunately. So it's, well, that's less than a decade, unfortunately, for the power law. So it's not very, more work needs to be done.
Well, what is unit here? What is long here?
This is in unit of the inverse wave vector laser.
Now, what would a PF be if these were fermions?
Oh, for fermions, you should, so for fermions, you should be getting a Fermi surface. If you have true fermions.
But I'm asking in this plot, if these were fermions, what would KF be? Where is
okay. KF should be here, I guess. KF or 2KF. No, KF is here, I think.
What is your capital K in the...
This is a Luttinger liquid parameter, and I can... Well, I might or might not have a later slide. Sorry about that. So interaction strength. So let's say U. Free fermions. So K is like this. And then gamma is the thing that usually people describe. And in the case of Hubbard model, it's roughly U over T. So the Luttinger liquid parameter for fermions is 1. For free fermions, and then positive for attractive interaction. So actually, I should have gamma is the other way around. So for large K, it means small gamma. Small gamma is this large gamma. Well, for bosons. Yeah, so for I'm mainly involved in fermions, so I'm going to talk about fermions, but zero here. For bosons, so this is fermions, this axis here. So repulsive. I'm not really going to talk about bosons, but just for reference. This line here is hardcore. And this side is repulsive. Okay.
What value of K is the straight line in the figure?
I think they use K equals 1. But as I, in fact, at this gamma parameter, K is probably not at 1. It's 1 point something. But well, because you only have a small range of momentum to fit, you can more or less fit any exponent between 1 and I don't know what. If you really want to pin down this K, Luttinger K, you need really more decades in momentum. But let's put it this way. This is not a free Bose gas.
Looks like the power law is minus 1 from the figure. Goes down 2 decades at N when it goes 2 decades in P.
Yeah, so it should be 1 over square root of P, this line here.
No, it's the root of P. It goes down, it changes by 2 decades on both axes.
No, this is 1 decade here and it's half a decade here.
It goes from 10 to the plus 1 to 10 to the minus 1 when it goes.
No, so from here to here is roughly half a decade. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't do that graph, so.
quick question.
Right.
When people say Thom's gas, do they mean k equals 1 or they mean k is arbitrary?
K equals 1. It's strongly interacting hardcore Bose gas.
They say also
Thom's
regime, so K is close to 1.
Yeah, for Bose gas case, which I don't really want to talk about, there is this Liebe-Lindinger, and you can directly compare K and what Liebe has computed for gamma and all that things. Yeah, so now I get on to the blackboard. So my main motivation is basically here to try to find interesting physics that's hard to realize in solids. So in particular, I'm going to talk about 1D physics. 1D physics, you can see it in some solid states, but not readily. But what's more, I want to show you in the two examples I'm going to talk about that there are systems that you can engineer in these cold atom lattices, which are quite hard to realize in solid systems, and therefore you get richer phase diagrams, for example. So systems hard to realize in solids. Sometimes people call this quantum engineering. But this is a great opportunity for us to study strong correlation physics in this new system. So with this out of the way, I will then define the model, which is, so this is part, let's just say outline. So there are basically two parts to it. I hope I get to the second part. The first part is two species, so up and down fermions.
Can I ask a possibly obnoxious question?
Yeah.
While you're writing, given that there's a huge amount of theoretical understanding of 1D physics, it's not too many problems that are actually challenging to understand there. What's the motivation just to engineer 1D physics?
Okay, so I'm not going to talk about this, but you're right. A lot of 1D physics is already understood, but 1D to 3D crossover, for example, is not so well understood. That Thierry talked about it in his talk about 1 or 2 months ago. The other thing is that, well, we're physicists at the end of the day, right? So we want to confront theory with experiments. Here, it's much more direct to be able to confront theory and experiments.
Yeah, I want to do that different ways. Okay. I want to push it.
Well, I think you could also say that you can have larger parameter spaces because you're an additional quantum universe. So in an end span, you're kind of stuck with fermions of spin a half and so on, which you're not here. So then you can ask if you have lots of scattering lines, are there different categories of quantum?
Want to explore all the Westmeadow model, the various
quantum
field
theories. Yeah, in principle.
You know, when confronted with a large parameter space, there's issues of good taste and aesthetics, but which bits you've got to look at.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I guess, does one have specific things in mind that one thinks are going to be interesting, or it's just parameter space is big.
Yes, so...
possible models, surely.
I mean, I agree. On the one hand, you can attack that everything's done. On the other hand, you can say the parameter space is too big. You know, not everything of those two arguments. If everything's done or not done on the parameter space, the smaller it's big. I want to make logical statements that way. But.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so let's... Yeah, so it's a matter of taste, to some extent. So the first part I'm going to study 1D systems, isolated 1D systems, where I load two species of fermions. And the new thing here compared to what you normally get in ordinary solids is to have T up not equal to T down. How you realize this? Well, clearly, if you load two types of fermionic atoms, spin-polarized, hyperfine state, only one hyperfine state in each of these cases, you get different masses. But Dieter Jaksch last week told us a little bit also about spin-dependent optical lattice, and people have already realized that, for at least for bosonic atoms. So you can engineer more or less continuously, for this case at least, tuning between T up and T down. And so for just a few more words, why did I say that it's not like ordinary solids? Because you can imagine either a situation of a couple ladders or putting on a magnetic field onto a spin half system, so spinless ladder or spin half fermions with magnetic field. In both cases, what you end up with is a spectrum that looks like this. You have a splitting of the Fermi point because of either the magnetic field or because of interchain hopping here. Here, I want to study a situation where N up is equal to N down at each side. This means I'm at a situation where, if essentially, both of my Fermi surfaces have the same KF. And so processes that are allowed here, changing Fermi points, are not allowed here, and we get different phases in general. There are some subsets which are similar. For example, Leon has studied some of these two-leg ladders system, and many other people have. But as far as I know, there's not much study for this particular situation here. And I'll show you some quite interesting phase diagrams. So the model is just nothing more nor less than the Hubbard model with the extension that I allow a spin-dependent hopping term here. And I have the usual Hubbard U here.
Yeah,
And I want to have the constraint that n up is the same as n down. By the way, it's clear that if I have these species, I can never interchange the up and down. So this corresponds to fixed magnetization, if you like. I also will study the case where n up plus n down is not 1. So I'm at half filling.
You could lose some preferentially of one species and therefore change the balance.
Yeah, and in practice also you can only tune things to maybe 1 or 2%, so you can ask the question how much of this physics survive, and I believe it should survive, especially when you have a gap. And the most of the phase diagram I will tell you about, in fact, does have a spin gap. So let's get back to this. So I'll try to study this. Firstly, when you have a spin-dependent hopping, I believe this model is no longer beta unsat solvable, unlike the standard spin half Hubbard model.
And the U is repulsive or attractive?
I will study both cases. And they can, in principle, tune it to be either sign in cold atom gases. The first thing I want to do is study this problem in the weak coupling limit using RG, and then I'll talk a little bit about strong coupling. So I'll save this part of the board to write down the phase diagram. So I have an extra tuning parameter, which in principle for spin-dependent optical lattice can be tuned continuously, which is the velocity difference or hopping difference. And I have the Hubbard U parameter here. And now I'll start off with this part here. Let's start off with the case when the hopping is equal. Then we know that for n up equals n down and n up plus n down not equal 1, there's a Luttinger liquid here. And then for attractive U, you get a spin gap, which is basically a superfluid. So I'll write superfluid here. And then delta S is not 0, the spin gap. So because I'm away from half filling, my charge gap is always going to be 0. Right, so strong coupling. Weak coupling first. So what we do is basically we try to linearize the spectrum, as usual, around the Fermi surface point, and then deduce write down a continuum model, and then do this standard geology model, where the G's refer to the processes that are available at low energy near the Fermi surfaces. So, for example, you have forward scattering, like this G2 parallel and G2 perpendicular, where the atoms, the fermions, are scattered, basically on the same side of the Fermi surface for equal spin, where this is the red one, and for opposite spin between red and green ones. So this perpendicular basically refers to different spin. And then there is the backscattering term here, just like in Hubbard model, where there is a 2kF transfer of momentum. And if you write down the RG equations, at first glance, a little bit more complicated than previously in Hubbard model. But in fact, the way I've written it, there's a combination involving the forward scattering, G2 parallel and G2 perpendicular, where you can combine those two equations. And in fact, you end up with just two equations. And in fact, it's nothing more nor less than the standard Kostolitz-Taulis phase diagram. So what does the phase diagram look like? So what does the KT flow look like? Just very quickly, to show you for people who know about it, then I'm just showing you how the velocity difference comes about. So on this axis here is essentially, I can never remember. So this is the backscattering term. And this is some combination of the forward scattering. Where alpha sigma is some parameter involving the velocity of the two species.
Backscattering meaning from one turning point to the other.
Yeah, the one that takes you from this one to this one and this one to this one. So if you have the standard Hubbard model, what happens is that your initial conditions where all these g's are proportional to u start on this line here. Either if you are positive u and you are here, or negative u, you are down here. So positive u, the backscattering just dies because it's this is a weak coupling flow, so you get back the Luttinger liquid. For strong coupling, you get to a phase with a spin gap opening. And I'll say a few more words about that later. But what happens when you have velocity difference? It turns out that you move away from this SU2 symmetric line. There are also these lines here, so I should put them in too. It turns out that for velocity, so the for finite velocity difference, you start out either here when you have positive u, or you start off here when you have negative u. So the main difference for the case of positive u is that you now start to flow to strong coupling again, unlike the case when you have equal velocity. Okay. So how to identify these phases here that the system flows to because of the velocity difference? This RG calculation was done using the fermionic basis. Now we can use some bosonization basis.
Can you talk about what the fixed line is?
Which one?
On the right hand side where the flows are actually stable.
Mm-hmm.
Now move to the right.
Here. Oh. If I remember right, we don't access this regime here by the initial conditions. Yeah, it should be a Luttinger liquid because the G backscattering just dies.
Right, but I mean, different velocity just breaks SU2 symmetry. You can do that by introducing, let's say, nearest neighbor interaction instead of onside, which actually is speed dependent.
It breaks it in a different way, though, right? So you're not,
But maybe another way to ask is, does that line have different velocities or not?
Oh, this one.
Yeah.
Yes. Because you still have. Let's see. Yes, it will have. It will no longer be a strict spin and charge separation, but you can just diagonalize the system, and you will still have some mode that is mostly charge and mostly spin, and they will have different velocities in the rotated basis. So it's just a Luttinger liquid.
But the modes are not purely spin or purely charge.
That's because when you have a velocity difference, you get a term that it couples the spin and charge, like this. And that's an equivalent term for the phase. And this depends on V up minus V down. Okay. And so that term couples your pure spin and pure charge, and rotate it a little bit away from that. Do I need to tell people how we figure out what these phases are? Because it involves a few lines of, a few more lines of bosonization. If not, I just state what they are. Happy? Okay. In those phases, both of those phases, what happens is that in the spin sector, you open a gap, and it's of the form So it's interesting that's non-analytic in the velocity difference parameter here. So once you start off away from equal velocity, you end up with something that has a spin gap here. And it's true on both sides. Well, this already has a spin gap, so let's continue. And what it turns out to be here is, in fact, for repulsive interaction, perhaps not surprisingly, what you get is some kind of spin density wave. In fact, it's an Ising one, because we have broken the spin SU2 symmetry by making the up and down not equivalent hopping. And it's an incommensurate one, because I'm not at half filling. It has a gap, but because it's an Ising, it's actually a long range order. Down here, you have a superfluid, as I say, which is basically a paired up fermions. Now, the interesting thing is that actually, because of the velocity difference, there are these terms that couple the spin and charge sector. So in fact, this term is not unimportant if you study the LG flow. And we have included this into the LG flow until the point where the spin gap opens. And then we integrate out the spin sector to see what happens. And we discover that once you integrate out the spin sector, when the spin gap appears, you actually can get a change in leading instability from a superfluid, which is where the pairs can move around, into a state where the pairs are locked into a charge density wave pattern. So in this phase here, it's a charge density wave of pairs. Kind of interesting, because somewhere down here, you actually have an SU2 charge symmetry here. And this is, of course, a crossover, because I'm in 1D. It's kind of unexpected. And I don't think you can get this phase in these two-leg ladder, spinless ladder, or these other models with magnetic field and so on. So this is all about weak coupling. The strong coupling case is actually easier to describe, because you can do the usual T squared over U kind of expansion, just like in higher dimensions. And it will not surprise you that, in fact, for, let's say, the repulsive U case, you get back an anisotropic TJ model. So strong coupling. It's not commensurate distance.
And power law?
Everything here is power law, except for this Ising one.
And presumably, if it were commensurate, then that CDW would have long range order. Is that clear, or do you know what happens?
If it's commensurate, then you will be gapping out both the charge and the spin sector. So, I guess so.
If you can take a TJ ladder and add a commensurate filling of 0.75 or 0.5 for a short range in J over T, lock up into, you move out of what would have been the spin gap superconductor as you go into a locked CDW of pairs.
Oh, okay. So you can get it in TJ ladder.
TJ, as long as you are commensurate, two ones we've seen in the 0.5
right. 0.75. Right. So the
as the lattice, of course, coming in on top of it.
Yeah. So you have 4 degrees of freedom, and also this case is interesting because it's incommensurate. Mm-hmm. Yes. So actually, since you're talking about it, I can also then show that, in fact, in the strong coupling limit, this CDW phase is actually also possible in the strong coupling limit. In fact, if you are near to half filling, you can demonstrate that what happens is strong coupling. You pair up these bosons into pair these fermions into a boson, and the boson have a residual interaction between them. So you end up with a model which is some T boson, B dagger B, and then you have a residual nearest neighbor interaction. But this is nothing more nor less than the bosonic way of writing down an XXZ spin chain. And depending on the anisotropy of the spin chain, you can end up with a gap or no gap. Here, it always has a gap again because of the velocity difference. And it turns out that you can actually have strong enough repulsion that you end up in the CDW phase. If you are at very, very dilute limit, however, the superfluid state phase will be more extended, I guess intuitively, because you don't have any tendency to lock things up into a periodic pattern. For the repulsive case, you directly get the TJ model, as I was about to tell you, except that the hopping is anisotropic. And the J part, again, is anisotropic because of the velocity difference. And it turns out that the J parallel is always bigger than J perpendicular. And so you again open the gap. So this is consistent with this scenario here. And you have, I've already rubbed out. You have this form of the gap, which is proportional to T up minus T down over U, something like that, both in the strong and the weak coupling. So it looks like everything is continuous here. So what I've said so far is mostly about down here when the velocity difference are not too big. When the velocity difference are huge, then a lot of what I said doesn't work because you can't really linearize the spectrum if one of the fermions have a very, very high mass, for example, and you can't do bosonization. In that limit, we know one place where we can say something solid. And that is in the limit where you switch off the hopping for one species. So this is the so-called Falikov-Kimball limit. If you switch that off, it turns out that there are exact solutions. So let's have this line here, where you actually get a phase separation up to some U critical for these parameters. So this here, we get all the heavy ones sitting on the heavy ones down here. Heavy ones sitting on one side, and then the light ones can fly around in the rest of the place. So this model actually continuously go from the standard Hubbard model to the Falikov-Kimball model. What's not known is whether this phase separation phase here can extend to a finite part of the phase diagram, in particular to observable kind of mass differences or velocity differences. Right. So this is, I guess, all I want to say about this problem, except for just a few more remarks. What can you see in the cold atom experiments? Well, you can see charge gap by just perturbing the overall density of the problem. To see the spin gap here, you need to do more work. So one of the possibilities of seeing the spin gap is due to a proposal by Hans-Peter Büchler, Sverger, 2004, I guess, which involves using a two-photon Raman process. So suppose I have a spin-up state and a spin-down state, which is separated by some distance because I have a spin gap and effectively they are no longer degenerate in some way. I can use a laser to take it up to some excited state with frequency omega 1, and then another one with a slightly different one, frequency with omega 2. So this process basically can flip the spin. This only works, of course, in hyperfine case. So if you look at the absorption spectrum when you have these two lasers going on, what you are measuring is basically this S plus, S minus correlation. And in principle, we are going to be at Q tending towards zero, which is kind of because the lasers are essentially homogeneous and long wavelength compared to everything else in the problem. And we can look at for various omegas, which is omega 1 minus omega 2 here. And so if you plot the spectrum as a function of omega, and this might be absorption, when there's a gap, you will not see anything until 2 delta. And then you should see something like this. And in fact, we have a computation for this. You take the problem, do spin charge separation, map the spin sector into a Sine-Gordon model, and use these form factor approach to compute this correlation function, which is what effectively we have here as a function of omega and Q equals zero. And the this singularity here, at least when the interaction is not strong, when K spin is on the order of one minus something, looks like a square root of omega squared plus. So one thing that I should emphasize is that because these interesting phases all occur already at weak coupling, you don't necessarily have to do a lot of hard work by using Feshbach and so on, although the gap will be somewhat small. That's true. So I don't know whether experimentally how easy it is to see this kind of spectrum when the gap is when the gap is on the small side because of this exponential dependence.
Why do you need two lasers? Why do you need omega 1 and omega 2? Why can't you just do a single radio frequency?
Yeah, I guess you can do that. I've forgotten why now. Are there any cold atom people here?
My impression was it's because whatever lasers are available have frequency which are much bigger than.
And this gap scale. But I seem to remember that also theoretically calculating this direct transition is more messy. I can't remember why, but okay.
It looks like you might have a problem with angular momentum.
Well, you have to define your angular. So I haven't told you what the angular momentum state. I mean, yeah. But in principle, this sort of experiment. No, I guess it has never been done yet, but people have proposed it also for studying the spin gap in BCS, BEC systems and other gap systems. You see, this is a spin gap which makes it harder to see than a charge gap.
Before you go on, and maybe this is a cold atom person question, but suppose you wanted to go to larger U over T. I don't know, you want to go to U over T of 4 or something, plus
right.
or minus 4. Is it easier to go down or up on the picture, as technically, for the experimentalist?
So you want to go this way?
I want to go that way.
And up to them.
And I want to know whether you're going to get much more range using Feshbach resonances or whatever.
Right.
If you go negative and if you go positive. And the reason I'm interested in this is if it were that you get more range as you go negative, then there's an advantage in studying negative U-Hubbard models, and there are ways, of course, as you know, with spin differences to make those into positive U-Hubbard models. Go.
Sure.
Be that as it may.
I think.
Is there technically some advantage in being able to do that, or does it just not matter? And you can. And once you set your lattice up, you can go up in this picture, or you can go down just as easily.
I think you can do it either way, right? So for the what Feshbach resonance does allow me to do is if you so in the continuum case, what happens is that the flashback resonance turns the scattering length to depend on magnetic field. In this way, right at resonance, you can actually tune it to be very repulsive. So I'm staying away from the molecular branch and on the still on the scattering branch. So you can either have very strong, very. However, when you put in a lattice, this divergence actually, in some sense, get renormalized. This work has been done. Actually, that I'll come back to that later because it's relevant to the two-band model. But in any case, it should be possible to arrange to get to U at least 10, 20 over T
side.
On either side.
And still be able to cool it. Is that going to happen?
Ah, okay. That's another question, yes.
No. That's another. Because I have to be able to go cold and not have something bad happen to me before I can make the switch.
Yeah, so
technically, not theoretically.
Yeah, I someone can answer.
So there is a problem, one difference in the two sides of these, which is that on the side with the scattering length is positive, there are bound states below that,
yep.
Molecular bound states. So there, you have the rate of three-body inelastic collisions is different on the two sides. So it may be that technically the lifetime of the system is shorter on the left than it is on the right. But that's I'm not.
But not a huge deal, maybe.
Well,
big enough that you'd rather, if you could study positive U Hubbard by studying the negative U. Would you rather, would that be a considered a positive thing for fibromyalgia, or do they just don't care?
I'm not a cold atom experimentalist. I'm going to stop my comments at what I just said.
Yeah. So I mean, this is one. This heating problem is presumably the reason why we still haven't seen any results about the 2D Hubbard model with fermions. Lots of people have been studying. So Esslinger's group, for example, have already been studying these problems of two hyperfine states of fermions in an optical lattice. And they have even gone into the 1D limit, and they have even tuned on these magnetic field. So that leads actually nicely to my second part. One more thing. So I mentioned that in these lattices, you can readily tune from 1D to 3D. So in principle, this phase diagram I've mapped out here, you can also try to take in 3D and see if these phases these states turns into real long-range order phases in 3D. It's simplest to analyze this if you have a spin gap. Because when you have a spin gap that's large compared to the perpendicular hopping between the chains, then you can more or less forget about single particle hopping. Okay? In that case, you have to look at higher orders, which is pair hopping or particle hole hopping. And if you analyze the situation, you'll find that what you expect that, for example, particle hole hopping will tend to stabilize this phase, and you will really turn this into a spin density wave or a charge density wave in this case. For particle-particle hopping. One of the amusing thing is that I haven't told you what. So there are all sorts of instabilities or power law correlation functions here. It turns out that in this phase here, you can get a triplet superfluid as a subleading order. But it's always subleading compared to the SDW phase. The difference between the two is that this one is a 2KF kind of order parameter, but this is not. So there is a. So you might try to dream up a way to kill these 2KF tendencies. And one possibility is to use these spin double period optical lattices. So if you have an optical lattice that looks like this, you'll have a KF1 here and KF2. So this is all perpendicular to the direction of the tube, okay? So the tube is coming out like this. And your number in this tube is higher than the number in this tube. So because of the mismatch in KF, you can, in principle, kill the 2KF kind of spin density wave here and end up with possibly a triplet superfluid. So this could be a way of engineering it. So then let's go on to the two-band model. How much time do I have? Another 20 minutes. Okay, so now I'm going on to more. I forgot to give you references. This work is Casalia, O, and Giamacchi. It's in the PRL 2005. So now I'm going on to the second problem here, which is directly more related to this Feshbach resonance. So I rubbed out that I shouldn't have. But in principle, again, just putting that back in, the interaction strength G is proportional to the A, the scattering. Well, it's just 4 pi A over M. And it can be tuned by using a magnetic field. So I have a magnetic field. Most of what you've heard so far about trapping atoms into the cold atom into an optical lattice assumes that you have a deep enough optical lattice so that the bands, the block bands, are all well separated. The energy separation is omega, some scale omega that you can usually write as an approximation to your true lattice. So if you do a harmonic oscillator form like this, then this omega scale that gives you the band, the level separation is basically square root of 4 times V naught E recoil, where V naught is the optical lattice strength. So it's the parameter in front of times psi dag of psi x. And then E recoil is the, so H optical lattice. And E recoil is just the energy that at corresponding to the lattice spacing here. Okay. So in most of these experiments that people have tried to look at, both Hubbard model and other cases, you are allowed to only study the lowest block band because the separation is large enough. However, when you are in the situation where you have Feshbach resonance, in principle, you can tune the interaction strength large compared to the band gap. And so you have an interesting possibility of introducing the second band into the game. So this is much more like doing multi-orbital physics in solid-state systems. So here is a way of quantum engineering various types of lattice models that involve more than one band, things like Anderson model or Kondo model, and so on. So in fact, for the theory of a single well, various people, including, I'll just quote the people I know. Dina and Ho has already studied the problem of a single well with Feshbach resonance physics to see what the spectrum looks like. And indeed, you can, not surprisingly, you can actually have eigenstate where atoms populate the higher bands. I'm not going to say a lot more about this physics. I just want to introduce a toy model to think about this problem of what happens when you are near or at Feshbach resonance and you have to worry about higher band situation. Okay, so the model that I study is the microscopic model I take as just the usual kinetic energy term plus a optical lattice. And I should put back spin. Now I'll assume that they are equal velocity. Equal mass. There's no mass dependence between the two species, so maybe hyperfine state. And then I have a interaction term between the up and down components. So I'm going to give you a really crude hand-waving argument as to why the kind of model that I want to study. So suppose I don't think very hard and I just basically introduce this scattering length A of B into here, A as a function of magnetic field, into this. It's a crude derivation. In fact, it's not even a derivation. It doesn't have all the correct physics that, for example, Diener and Ho has studied. And it also doesn't tell you anything about three particles states, what happens when you have three particles in a well. But let's just see what kind of toy model we should study. So since I'm in an optical lattice, in a lattice situation, let's expand in terms of Vanier functions. And I'm going to study a toy model where I only need to worry about two Vanier functions. So I have a band index, which is the lowest band and the first band, which whatever the first band that can, that is active in this case here. If you do this and just plug it into the expansion above, plug the expansion into the microscopic Hamiltonian, you end up with a two-band model, basically a Hubbard model for two bands that has some hopping between the bands. I have a standard U term within the same band. And then I also have terms that relate the different bands, alpha not equal to beta.
Is spin essential here?
Yes, I will be talking about spin later on. But unlike previously, the T here is independent of spin. But it can, of course, it depends on which band it is. And then I have some extra terms here. Which will not surprise you if you are familiar with deriving lattice models from a microscopic model in solids either. Because this bit here is basically Hund's rule coupling. It has the same physics as exchange in a single orbital, two orbital system in a hydrogen atom, for example. And the minus sign tells me this is Hund's rule, which tends to line up the spin in the two orbitals. And there's a pair hopping term also, it turns out, that takes a pair of atoms from the lower band to upper band or vice versa. Doug, you know whether what's the name of this model in condensed matter? It must have been studied. Yeah. In any case, one thing I should mention is that I haven't told you, but in fact I've already specialized to 1D. The reason is that in higher dimensions, for example, in the first band will be a P band, and the P orbital can point in various directions. And so depending on whether your P orbital are parallel or not, you'll get very different hopping between them. And so you end up with a much richer 3D kind of model than what I've written down. Here, when you are 1D, then it's simpler. So I want to study the simpler case first. One more thing I need to add, which is to describe the splitting between the bands, which is just N alpha sigma I here. So I have these parameters that I can tune U versus mu alpha, and I will take mu up minus mu down to be basically the band gap omega naught. Okay. So in pictures, we can very quickly find out what's going on here. If I am in the limit of very weak U's compared to the this band gap scale, then of course you put everything into the bottom. So you have a band insulator. Now, if you go into the opposite limit where, so I forget about that bit here. If I now go to the other limit where the these U's are bigger than the band gap scale, then it pays to put fermions up into the next band to avoid on-site same band interaction, which is typically larger than interaction between bands. Okay, so I end up with something like this. Now I put them as some parallel spin, and that comes from this bit here, the Hund's rule. Then you can ask the question, how do I put the rest? And it's perhaps not surprising that, at least at the filling, I'm talking about two sites per lattice sites, two fermions per lattice sites. I end up with a Mott insulator. You can think of it as two half-field Hubbard model that are coupled by the Hund's rule term. The Hund's rule lock these guys into a spin one triplet. So in fact, you end up with a spin one Heisenberg in the spin sector. And for 1D, spin one Heisenberg is a very interesting object. It's a spin liquid with a gap to spin excitations. So what?
Yeah. Are you going to talk about what happens
at the transition?
Yeah. Whether the charge gap is zero.
Yes, I do not know for sure because I haven't really managed to finish doing that stuff. And also the other problem is that I need to know what these values or parameters are just to make sure I know what's going on. But here's what I do know. So energy gaps, okay. So we know that in the band insulator, you have spin gap and charge gap, both of them. And then somewhere over here, you also have spin gap and charge gap. It's still a Mott insulator, so that's presumably still a charge gap. And I've just told you that I have a spin one Heisenberg, so there's also a spin gap on this side. The spin gap is on the order of J, the effective exchange between these systems here. I've forgotten the number now. It's what, 0.4 or something like that, J? And J is dependent on is T squared over U kind of scale. And in my paper, I have explicitly what those horrible T expression should look like. So you have a scale which is smaller here. So here you have to join the dots here. What happens at the transition, U critical? The simplest is just basically everything is continuous.
You don't have to have a transition, right?
Spin gap.
In fact, yeah, there is no transition.
The spin gap has to close.
Why?
Or it's first order.
Because you have boundary states at in the spin one chain that are spin one halves, and they have to go away somehow, so then you need to take those states have to
right.
Close the ball.
Right.
What happens with a single site?
Single site?
Yeah. Well, that's there's already an issue there, actually. It's
why?
Because it has to go from a singlet to a triplet.
Yeah, so right at that point, the singlet and triplets are degenerate.
Okay. So then the issue is what the hopping does to...
Yeah, so. However, it's conceivable. Okay, yeah, I agree that it's conceivable. Right at this point, you have a jump, which may be first order. The interesting thing, though, is that the ground state, even though you may have a spin gap dying, but the ground state may be adiabatically connected between the two.
Leon, let me ask you this.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay. I think Doug knows about
Suppose I have a two-way ladder, let's have a two-way cupboard that's half filled.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to modify T per over T. I'm going to make T per bigger and bigger and bigger. Then presumably I move into a band insulator or something.
Right.
And then I start dropping it down.
But that's not the same as this phase. That's the wrong singlet phase. It's different from the spin one.
Down below,
the effective,
down below I have a spin gap, and it's a bit like a spin one.
It's not like a spin one. It doesn't have boundary states, right? Again, if you put a hands on it, you just can fill up all the rows, right? So the difference is topological between that.
So the spin half fill.
No, but
spin ladder that has a reasonable U over, sorry, equal hotness.
Yeah.
Is not be thought of as a spin one chain.
If you took two Heisenberg chains with ferromagnetic coupling between them rather than anti-ferromagnetic, right, then that could be thought of as a spin one chain, not with anti-ferromagnetic.
No, but I thought there are arguments coming from that, a paper by some called Eugene Kim, which...
So there are conditions that you have to maintain a topological distinction. If you start fiddling and putting diagonal bonds that destroy some of the symmetries.
But you can turn all these things continuously.
Well, it's like an Isaac model. You know, we say that the ferromagnetic and the paramagnetic state are distinct. But if you turn on a magnetic field, you can connect them smoothly. So, you know, things are distinct within some symmetry classes. And those models you were looking at is like that, I think.
Maybe analogy is look at the two-leg ladder, but changing the wrong interaction from positive to negative. That does have a critical point.
Yeah.
Which is zero.
Just two Heisenberg models.
Yeah.
And that's a non-generic version of the critical point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What would be the generic version?
Well, there's no reason that it should be equivalent to two decoupled chains.
So in fact,
some Ising transition.
Yeah. So down here
single C equals one theory. It's well known thing. Probably Duncan worked it out.
Leon, you say this has to be then first. This has to have something special then.
Well, either
right,
the spin gap vanishes in a continuous transition, or there's a first-order transition. If it's continuous, the spin gap has
to vanish. But most phases in a two-leg ladder have a spin gap, so that has to be a very special place.
Phase transition means you tune one parameter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's your tuning parameter.
Yeah, so I need to know about these parameter U's before I can really figure out whether... I have an effective theory there, which is basically... these ladders with lots of, just as you say, lots of these things going on, and also this J is not the same as that J, so it's a really messy problem. And but the main problem is I still don't know what these U's are, and I think I'm talking with Hu Shuai here. We may figure out a way of computing these U's, and then I can really plug it into here and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I think I remember it's something. It's like one massless boson rather than two. So it's a C equals one theory, not a C equals two. It's a Wessamino little.
A full boson. Because on this side you have three Majoranas for the spin one. Right? And then on this side, I guess you have.
Yeah,
we should talk, yeah. So I guess that's more or less all I have to say. Oh, and the other thing I have not studied is that if you turn the lattice less steep, so there will be interesting metal insulator transitions there, presumably. And finally, one more thing is that experimentally they have already seen this sort of physics of kicking, having atoms up into the higher band. So this is a work of Esslinger's group. I think it's last year. So the first author is actually Mikhail Cole.
Say kicking up, you mean by artificially or by...
No, by just turning the magnetic, the flashback resonance. So let me show a picture of that. I hope I have it here. Wait, come on. Oh, okay. So this is the tuning parameter magnetic field towards the flashback resonance. Well, the flashback resonance is somewhere here. And this is plotting the fermion atoms in the higher band. This is a time of flight momentum distribution map. And this is the first Brillouin zone. So they are not quite at exactly two fermions per side. So even far away from the flashback resonance, they see a few atoms. I don't know whether this is because of thermal effects or whether they have more atoms than strictly
spatial inhomogeneity.
Yes, yes, and also because of spatial inhomogeneity, where you, at some bit might be exactly two and some bit more than that. So they see a, and so the what they see is that they see atoms getting kicked up into higher band, which is somewhere here. So they have an anisotropic 3D lattice, so that you don't have to worry about the PXP, YPZ orbital degeneracy. So they have preferentially kicked out into here. So this number here is actually still not yet modeled theoretically.
What are the white and the black dots, tuning different distances from that?
Oh, boy, what was that? I forgot now. It was some control experiment, which I've forgotten what exactly it was. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember what that was. Okay. So this is all I have to say. Well, barring Leon's question of what's new there, what's interesting there, I hope I've shown you that you can do some interesting physics in optical lattices in studying systems that are analogous, but sometimes going beyond what we can do in solids. So thank you for your attention.